Patrick Henningsen and TNT.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world, and welcome to the Patrick Henningsen Show. Today, Thursday, the 25th of April, 2024, and I'm Basil Valentine, sitting in for Patrick Henningsen today. Now, I had prepared a terrific opening monologue in the style of our absent host, but I've got such terrific guests lined up for today's program that it seems a shame to take up any of the time with my ramblings when we can get straight on with the program. First off, I'm honored, I must say, to be joined by Dr. Frank Romano. Frank is an international lawyer currently representing the Palestinian people at the International Criminal Court. The International Criminal Court is the one that's been sitting on its hands, in spite of Frank's best efforts, the one in which Karim Khan was so quick to issue an arrest warrant for Vladimir Putin and yet so slow to do so for Benjamin Netanyahu. I'll be asking Frank about that situation, but even more up to date, Frank is currently in Istanbul and hopes to be boarding ship tomorrow as one of the volunteers on the Freedom Flotilla attempting to break the starvation blockade in Gaza. Frank currently in Istanbul, as I say. Then at 9:30, I will be joined by former Labour Member of Parliament for Derby, Chris Williamson. Chris is now Deputy Leader of the Workers' Party of Great Britain and one of the leading authorities on the Middle East and Britain's egregious foreign policy in particular. So I'll be talking about all things related to that, Gaza, Ukraine, as well, of course, as some domestic issues and the prospects for the Workers' Party of Great Britain at this year's general election, which could be this summer, but everybody thinks is much more likely to be in the autumn. Then in the second hour, I'm joined by Blake Lovewell, intrepid investigative reporter, who has been doing a deep dive into what's going on in West Africa, and in particular Niger, following the coup there last year and the more recent expulsion of French troops. That promises to be fascinating. And then finally, in the second hour tomorrow, I'll be joined once again by host of State of the Nation, Brian McLean, for an update on the unprecedented clashes and demonstrations at campuses across America, which have only intensified in the last 24 hours. To bring us up to date with that, I've just seen a clip of the head of the philosophy department at Emory University, Georgia.
We've heard lots of Israeli spokespeople over the last few days saying this is a false narrative, that it's not true that people in Gaza are on the brink of starvation. From what you've seen, are people on the brink of starvation?
Yes. It honestly depends where you are, and the situation is worse the higher up you go through the Gaza Strip. So the middle area compared to Rafah, it's worse. North compared to the middle area, worse again. And I honestly was shocked today, Krishnan, at this hospital in the middle area by the number of children and adults that I saw who looked incredibly malnourished. And the head of pediatrics there told me that the number of cases he's admitting in general have gone up 3 times. And of those, 90% of the children that are being admitted have malnutrition.
So what is the problem in terms of getting the aid that is coming across the border out? I mean, Israel says there is more aid coming in now than there was before. So where is it?
Well, I don't agree that there's more aid coming in now than there was before. I just had a look at the numbers that we have on the trucks coming in. And since the beginning of March, we've averaged 156 trucks a day. Now, before the war, it was 500. The little aid that we do get in, we then have to take it through a war zone. These two crossings that we have are both in the south. So we then have to traverse the entire Gaza Strip. And as we saw with the tragic incident on Monday night where our colleagues were killed, it's not safe here. The systems that are meant to protect us are not functioning. And then on top of that, there's all sorts of logistical issues like damage to roads, crowded streets, telecommunications blackouts. It's really, really difficult.
What's the United Nations spokesperson? Direct from Gaza there, hence the blue helmet, explaining some of the difficulties associated with getting aid to the starving in Gaza. I'm delighted to say I'm joined now by Dr. Frank Romano, direct from Istanbul, as he prepares to join the Freedom Flotilla, hopefully sailing within the next few days. I gather you've been given permission to board ship tomorrow, Frank, and we hope that that is just the start of a successful mission. To say it's much needed is the understatement of the year.
Yes, to follow through with what's just been said. When people are dying of starvation, and that's a horrible death, and of course, not in security, it makes our efforts even more urgent. However, and we've got some issues with there's an Israeli contestation. They are contesting our departure. There was a whole group of countries here with their agents trying to convince President Erdogan not to let us leave, let our flotilla leave. We're on the boat bringing 5,500 tons of food and medicine. So there was the United States, there was Germany, there was the UK and Israel. Now Israel, I think, has filed a new they're contesting the departure on a technical issue. So it doesn't look like we're going to leave tomorrow. It looks like day after tomorrow. And this has been going on, however, for about 10 days. It says, well, in the next, all our technical issues on the boat set up. We've got about to join. And then there is negotiations going. Have not said no, but they haven't given us the green light yet.
I'm very disappointed.
Just to add, the government, apparently, it's not the issue with the Turkish government now. It's like I say, Israel has contested this, and so we're having to, they're bringing an investigation, and there's a delay of a couple more days.
I was very disappointed to hear the United Kingdom amongst the countries objecting and putting pressure on the Turkish government not to let you sail. We hear all the time from the likes of David Cameron, and for that matter, the Secretary of State, Tony Blinken as well, that they're all so mad keen to get more humanitarian aid in. It seems like the US and the UK want to fatten people up before they blow them to bits, or at least appear to be alleviating the starvation. So on what possible grounds would the US and UK have to hold up your humanitarian mission?
You know, that is the question. However, what our focus is, what grounds could there be for, you know, the Gazans, basically, and I'm a father, they're in famine, desperation right now in many parts of Gaza, but it's security. I mean, we all relate to people, to everyone would like security in their homes. And when the child comes home from school, if there's any school left, or comes home from trying to find food, and he walks through the door or through the tent door, or there's no door at all now, a lot of them are sleeping in the streets, his father wants to give his son a hug and boom, he's killed before his eyes. The security issue, everyone wants security. That's the thing. And also, obviously, to be able to feed their children. And if their children or members of their family or anybody is sick, they want to have hospitals that have, most of them have been destroyed. There's very few operational hospitals in Gaza. So bottom line is, to answer your question, it's sort of a roundabout way, but I think it's very relevant. I think it's very relevant that it seems like any grounds are spurious, and not to allow our aid in, because it's like 5,500 tons. That's not enough to feed all of Gaza. But it's bringing the attention of the world to the fact that we're willing to put our lives and our security on the line of time. We're a lot of our professionals and we have jobs to assist through, bring media attention to the plight, the serious plight of the Gaza. And we want to break that. We want to show it's possible to boat. Will serve as a precedent for other boats and other people attempting to bring in much needed aid to the Gazan people.
Frank, you've been campaigning on the Palestinians' behalf for many years. Would you say that you've noticed a sea change in public opinion and public perception over the last 6 months?
Well, I have to attribute to you, the journalists that have got the word out more. And I see, I'm not to be overly cynical, but I don't see a huge impact on public opinion in general. I see lots of demonstrations I've organized and participated in France and New York. You hit upon one of the main reasons why we have this flotilla, is we really would like, and being French-American, I have a vested interest as an American who votes and pays taxes in both and France as well, that our governments are pressured to no longer enable this occupation, enable this genocide by sending arms and money, unbridled amounts, to Israel as well as European countries, namely another one I'm from, because I'm a French American again, France. But I do see more and more movements. We saw today and yesterday and other days, the universities are starting to erupt in the U.S. and other countries. That may or may not, however, have an effect, long-term effect on public opinion. Is it going to manifest during the elections so that maybe a candidate will come to the fray and will do the right thing in spite of wanting to kowtow to Israel? And most American politicians are receiving money. I don't know. I hate to say it. I just don't know if it really has a tremendous impact, especially long term, on public opinion.
I would say that I think there has been a sea change, particularly amongst young people. Palestine has become a cause worldwide, which 9 months ago it simply wasn't. It was very much on the back burner, and that's where Western politicians like to keep it. Of course, the only defense that the bought and paid for AIPAC lobbyists masquerading as representatives of the American people have got is to claim it's all anti-Semitic. Governor Greg Abbott has sent in the Texas National Guard to University of Texas at Austin to break up a demonstration there. And the educationally subnormal Mike Johnson went to Columbia yesterday and started talking about the virus of anti-Semitism, when what you have is Gentiles, police, arresting Jewish students for being anti-Semitic because they object to a genocide. It's all completely upside down, Frank.
Yes, but you know, we are against anti-Semitism and any type of racism. But the bottom line is then, if people are talking about racism and ethnic cleansing and anti-Semitism, this is what we're trying to address, what's happening in Israel. The Palestinians for decades have been persecuted based upon their ethnic origins. And now we see a clear manifestation of this in the attempt by the Israeli government to wipe out an entire civilization and using the Hamas attack as a pretext to do that. We're trying to say, wait a minute, that has been spun anti-Semitic. But then to criticize Israel for engaging in the systematic massacre of a civilization, that is a form of racial discrimination and ethnic cleansing, just as serious. Can't we address that? But it's back again to the propaganda of anti-Semitism, and we're focusing on the plight of the Palestinians.
I'm very glad that you are, because it is what is, invariably neglected in all this. Apparently, the feelings, real or otherwise, of the odd Jewish student are far more important to the American polity and press than the massacre of thousands of children and mutilation of tens of thousands more. It really is quite bizarre. Israel Netanyahu once again said just yesterday that, you know, they're obviously very frightened by this eruption of protest across American universities. And he attempted to claim on television that it was reminiscent of Germany in the 1930s. Now, it's fundamentally dishonest and really very sinister to try and claim that people objecting to genocide, that's what all these protests are about. They're nothing to do with hating Jewish people. They are about the strongest possible way trying to get their universities to divest from anything to do with a country that is committing genocide. And to tar them with the brush of anti-Semitism is abysmal. It's as simple as that, Frank. Now, I want to just bring us up today quickly with a development today, which is that the leader of 18 countries, including the US and the UK, have called on Hamas to free Israeli and dual national hostages held in Gaza. This letter was signed by France and the United States, amongst others, and comes after the breakdown of all the peace talks. It doesn't appear to make any mention of the thousands of hostages held in the Israeli gulag. Now, should Hamas accept these terms, they are only talking about a prolonged ceasefire, but that means that hostilities will start again. It really is the worst possible situation, Frank, but do you see any pathway to peace from where we are now?
Well, I've been studying that extremely closely, and not to take the emphasis off the famine, the persecution, the genocide that's happening today before our eyes, I noticed a very similar, and I'm sure you have too, with what's going on now. Hamas actually has never really specifically said this, and this is very new and something to be dealt with seriously. They are saying, okay, we'd be willing to, lay down our arms. So sort of the wording that you lay down our arms if we can, and if we can have a Palestinian state, and we'll integrate our party and actually combine with Fatah, as long as, well, at the same time we can liberate, the Palestinian hostages, even though the Israeli doesn't want to call them that. They really are the same hostages from all these wars that have been accumulating, thousands of them accumulating over the time. What does that remind us of? Doesn't that remind us a bit of what happened in Ireland? And Hamas has never taken it to that extent, as far as I know. That is a gesture that I think that might be appealing, as opposed to simply Hamas deciding to release the hostages on the condition there'll be a permanent ceasefire. That takes it to the level that I think should be. In other words, if there were a solid, organized structures of a two-state solution proposed, that would take the wind out of the sails of Hamas, because Hamas thrives on fighting the occupation. Well, since there is now a Palestinian state, there's not much to attack, and the wind in the Hamas sails will subside, and we'll have a new generation. They're even suggesting, Hamas, that they'll get involved in the political system, just like the IRA did in Ireland. Secondly, once that happens, then the wind out of the sails of the ultra-right, Ben-Gvir and Smoltek and all the others, along with others in Netanyahu's cabinet, that takes the wind out of the sails, because their whole thing is, we've got to defend ourselves against terrorist attacks. There won't be. There are always crazies on both sides. They'll continue this a bit. But for the most part, there won't be this attack from Palestine, because they will have their own state. So taking it one step further, we have to be realistic about it, but I really feel that Israel does not want that. They don't want to do what happened in Ireland. They don't want to take it at that level. They really do want this genocide. They want the Palestinians out. They want their land. They want to push them into like Bantustans forever, like the Indians in the reservations in the U.S., and not have any type of integration and not have any durable peace.
I'm afraid you're right. And to bring us up to date with the situation at the ICC, where Karim Khan may or may not be about to issue arrest warrants for Benjamin Netanyahu and others possibly in the Israeli cabinet, that brings into sharp focus really this sort of clashing versions of reality that there are, because Netanyahu, believe it or not, is claiming to be the force for good. And in that respect, he's backed up by a lot of the talking heads on Capitol Hill, when we all know that he is a mass murderer and belongs at The Hague well in advance of Vladimir Putin. I was pleased to see Nancy Pelosi rowing in with Chuck Schumer this week and saying that he's got to go. But they're much misled if they think that anybody replacing him is going to be any better, aren't they, Frank?
Yes, I think we have to be realistic. When he stepped down, or when he was pushed down, who took over? Well, Bennett. Bennett is even a little more far right than Netanyahu. And I know that personally because I first got in really big trouble when I was in El Kana Akma, the Bedouin village. I know you're familiar with it. East of Jerusalem became a central a center for Palestinian resistance. Bulldozers were coming in. We had no arms, and we thought, well, should we step in front? Then we thought of Rachel Corrie, and said, but we stepped in front. Fortunately, we didn't get run over, but we all went to jail. At that very time, Bennett, who was not prime minister, was saying, we have got to destroy El Kana Akma. Netanyahu was the one member of government that that pled at the time that maybe we should pull back and not be too hasty about it. And I was thinking, gee, I have that in my memory. Then when Bennett became prime minister, I thought, oh, that's it for El Kana Akma, but it's still standing. In other words, we have to be realistic. Who's going to replace him? But getting back to the ICC, I don't know if the listeners know this, but I'm one of the original lawyers that have filed a complaint with the ICC. And this is a criminal court, so it has to be against individuals, not against the state. It's not like the people confuse it with the International Court of Justice, which we heard a decision, and we can address that later, that was instigated by South Africa. That's a whole different deal. The International Criminal Court it came into effect in 2004. Palestine's a member, filed a complaint, and it was around 2020, State of Israel contested jurisdiction. So we were all drafting complaints, and especially El Haq from Ramallah, who's been advising me on my complaint, and we focused on the jurisdiction issue, because in any case we're involved in, you always start with jurisdiction. And it's logical, because if the court decides it doesn't have jurisdiction, case is over. And that's exactly what Israel wanted. Israel wanted the court to say we had no jurisdiction. We fought several months and we won a victory. The International Court of Criminal Court in The Hague claimed judged that it had jurisdiction over the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza. Then, 2021, the same year, El Haq and other lawyers, including myself, we all filed separate complaints. Now, again, it's a criminal court. You cannot file a criminal complaint against a state, a government. Why? Well, you can't put the government in jail. You can only file a complaint against individuals. So who did I choose to be on my complaint? I filed a complaint for violation of war crimes, crimes against humanity, and other crimes against Netanyahu, Gantz, Lieberman, Obama, and Trump, who were definitely accomplices to these crimes. And that was three, four years ago. And El Haq as well. Since then, nothing has happened. The procedure starts with once they get the investigation done, which they said in many letters, it's finished, the investigation. We can go into why I say that. But then the next step is summons to appear are issued by the ICC to the defendants. And if they don't comply, just like in the United States or in other jurisdictions, then the court will issue arrest warrants. None of that has happened. since 2019. In fact, Palestine issued its initial complaint 2014 about the Castled wars and the other wars there. And so since we all filed our complaints after the court claimed jurisdiction, nothing has happened 3 or 4 years. And the prosecutor, Ben Zud, originally Ben Zud, has changed to Karim Khan. But what did Karim Khan do recently? He goes to Bab Refa in the beginning of this latest conflict, and he notices there's not much humanitarian aid coming in. He didn't really talk about his own responsibilities. Then he goes visiting Israeli families that have filed complaints before the ICC for war crimes committed by Hamas. And I wouldn't say they're invalid. I mean, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. Hamas did commit war crimes, but Karim Khan only visited the families of the Israeli, Israeli hostages who filed a claim against Hamas for war crimes and did not visit the Palestinian families. So we see already clear partiality. It's become very politicized, and if the ICC is going to act, it should be now, of course, and that's obvious. But nothing. And we hear these rumors that it could submit arrest warrants. And I was with El Haq. El Haq came to Istanbul in solidarity with the flotilla. And I talked with him and said, where do these rumors come from? I don't think the IC has said that. Maybe you have an in on this. Where the rumors are coming from, the ICC is going to issue arrest warrants against Netanyahu and other defendants, because I don't see any signs that the ICC is going to make any move at all to do what it should do, and that is proceed against the commission of very serious war crimes, including genocide, by Israeli agents.
Quickly, Frank, and I can't thank you enough for joining us this evening. One last question. The pier made out of partly human remains and the rubble of Palestinian homes is apparently now under construction further south than where it was ideally wanted, and therefore further away from those most in need. Do you know if that's where you're planning on docking, how long it will take you to get to Gaza? And, you know, just a final quick wrap about the status of the flotilla.
Yes. It will take once we're in the boat and we're departing, it will take 5 to 6 days to get into the region. In other words, international waters close enough to Gaza, where we think probably will be hijacked by the Israeli Navy and so forth. I do not know what port is targeted. I have heard the government's making all these claims, the U.S. government making all these claims that they've started it. But other evidence shows that they haven't made much construction, and yet they said very shortly we'll be able to use that. So I don't know. I don't know where this flotilla plans to land. I'm hopeful it can land. I'm hopeful that the governments of the world, first of all, will assure our protection, so we can land with this very important load for the Gazans, to food and medicine. But I've been told most likely will be hijacked. The goods hopefully will get, they'll distribute once they've been checked them, once the Israeli forces have checked them, will go to the Gazans, but we'll go to jail. Basically is what we think is going to happen. Hopefully not.
Well, that would be a massive own goal, not only for Israel, but for the United States, the United Kingdom, and all the other so-called liberal democracies. Currently cracking down on protest against the genocide. Frank, thank you so much for joining us tonight on today's News Talk. We wish you all the best and Godspeed with your heroic mission, and I look forward to speaking to you again very soon.
Thank you. Thank you very much, and thank you, listeners.
We're going to take a short break now. When we come back, I'll be joined by Chris Williamson, former Labour MP for Derby, and now the Deputy Leader of the Workers' Party of Great Britain, for his take on the current international situation and the prospects for his party this autumn. We'll be right back.
Los Angeles has been described as a suburb looking for a city. Join me as we explore LA's neighbourhoods and the local restaurants, cafes and bars that are an integral part of these vibrant and diverse communities.
Today we are going to cook a small steak for people who are really quite hungry.
Very, very simple. A couple squeezes of lemon in there.
Since you're adding the meat, and you can also do it with tofu options as well for the vegetarians.
Olive oil. So now we're going to season it up. Fresh grind black pepper.
Really hot and busy in here.
I'm going to go ahead and make some butter toast.
Olive oil.
Smells good.
Grab our shiitake mushrooms.
Season with salt a little bit.
Boy, it's getting hot in the kitchen. Need another drink of my beer. That's the best part of cooking.
And we are ready to put our plate together.
Add the mussels right around the rim. See, we have really nice colors, nice piece of fish.
We just need to add a little bit of powdered sugar.
And I will just put a little bit of reduction glaze over the top.
When you add a pesto like this onto a braised meat, the smells that just come up are just wonderful. Take it from me, we've got a good thing going here.
Affordable housing, we can build that. Sustainable housing, we can build that. At MIT Modular, we understand the importance of housing for all and the importance of design, cost, and functionality. Our goal is to meet the needs of our growing population by converting shipping containers to livable units. If you're like-minded and in a position to invest in something meaningful and life-changing, we want to hear from you. We are a team of professional architects, engineers, and financial and tax experts dedicated to offering unique solutions that provide a brighter future. Our Opportunity Zone Fund offers investors both real estate and operating business diversification. 5-year tax deferral on capital gains, annual tax benefits, and ultimately tax-free appreciation potential. There are opportunity zones all over America. If you're interested in learning more about our services, need affordable housing, or want to participate in creating a new vision for tomorrow, give us a call in the U.S. on 385-985-5702 or read more at mitmodular.com. MIT Modular. We can build that.
It's time to switch on today's news talk radio.
Very entertaining.
Yeah! TNT.
Welcome back to the Patrick Kennison Show with me, Basil Valentine, sitting in for Patrick today, Thursday, the 25th of April. Around 80 students walked out of Greenshaw High School in Leafy Sutton in Surrey today in response to local Tory MP Paul Scully, who voted against a ceasefire coming to visit the school. The students walked out demanding an immediate ceasefire and an end to all arms sales to Israel. Outside the school gates, one student, a speaker, said, "We remember those whose culture is being annihilated. This is happening in Gaza as we speak, and it has been happening across Palestinian land for decades. Israel is destroying their culture." I'm delighted to say I'm joined on the line now by Chris Williamson. Chris, that's just one example of many, particularly in the United States, of just how galvanized people have become in support of the Palestinian cause over the last 6 months.
Absolutely. People's consciousness has been raised. The scales have fallen from people's eyes. And it's really inspiring to see how young people are rising to the challenge and not being browbeaten or intimidated into complying and to, as it were, demonstrating some form of respect for an MP who frankly deserves no respect. Anybody who can essentially facilitate and support a genocide deserves the contempt with which they were shown today by these excellent students at that school that you mentioned.
It really is a sea change. And for people who would ideally like to see the end of Zionism, like you and me, and by that we mean the end of the ethno-supremacist state of Israel, not the end of the living of all Jewish people living in historic Palestine, also known as the Holy Land, but rather the way it is presently constituted. Now, that was considered a particularly sort of extreme position 6 or 7 months ago, but in The Guardian today, liberal former Zionist Naomi Klein is typical of those enlightened Jewish people who now feel the same way. "We need an exodus from Zionism," she writes. "This Passover, we don't need or want the false idol of Zionism. We want freedom from the project that commits genocide in our name." Now, it doesn't seem that that message that there are lots of Jewish people opposed to Zionism has got through to the mainstream media or the idiots in Westminster or Capitol Hill who seem determined to categorize all opponents of genocide as anti-Semitic, even the Jewish ones. It's nonsense, Chris, isn't it?
Well, complete nonsense. And of course, let's remember when the Labour Party was going through its travails over the bogus anti-Semitism crisis, many of the people that were being targeted were themselves Jewish. Indeed, I remember speaking up for one individual whose parents had survived Auschwitz. He was accused of anti-Semitism and accused of bringing the party into disrepute and thrown out as a consequence. But look, the Zionist project has, you know, traditionally kind of overreached, really. You know, they never take sort of yes for an answer. They're always wanting more, as it were, and they've overreached in this instance, it seems to me, and they're being burnt as a consequence of it. People are waking up to the fact that it is a racist settler colonial ideology and has no place in the civilized world. And it's great to see the likes of Naomi, better late than never, as they say, at last calling out Zionism. And I think that we're potentially now seeing the final chapter of the Zionist project. I think we will live to see the day, and maybe in the not too distant future, where we will see a genuine free Palestine. It's an absolute tragedy that so many people have had to suffer, lose their lives, and not just in this genocide that's taking place right now, but this has been going on, let's remember, for, at least 76 years, and indeed before that, but certainly since the Zionist entity was created in 1948 and the expulsion of 750,000 Palestinians and then the countless massacres that have taken place in the intervening years leading up to the genocide that we're seeing unfolding before our eyes now. And, you know, people have had enough, and they are, as we saw with the school students, you know, simply not prepared to put up with this anymore. And I think a lot of these politicians will pay a price. They'll pay a price at the elections. And we're going to have a lot of elections in the Western world, aren't we, this year? There'll be a general election in Britain, for example, a presidential election in the United States. And, people are, expressing their horror, their revulsion at what is happening and their absolute contempt for the politicians who are facilitating it and are complicit. And, you know, some of these people might find themselves in the dock. I certainly hope they do. They deserve to be. The likes of Rishi Sunak and Sir Keir Starmer. Let's remember Sir Keir Starmer, who said that the Israelis had the right to cut off water and energy to the Palestinian people. Absolutely shocking behaviour. And these people really don't deserve to hold public office at all. And as I say, they should be in the dock in The Hague.
I wholeheartedly agree with you, Chris. But it seems that in the United States, they're prepared to rip up their own constitution and crack down with violence on perfectly peaceful protesters objecting to genocide. We've got a clip here, for example, of the censorship dimension. Senator Pete Ricketts of Nebraska, the former governor of that state, a Republican, who let slip what the purpose of banning TikTok is, as we can hear now in this clip from C-SPAN.
Look what's happening at our college campuses right now in this country. Pro-Hamas activists are taking over public spaces and making it impossible for campuses to operate. Jewish students are being told to leave campus because their universities can't guarantee their safety. There are a lot of other things wrong with this, including the failure to prioritize student safety over appeasement of terrorist sympathizers. But why is this happening? Well, let's look at where young people are getting their news. Nearly a third of adults 18 to 29, these young people in the U.S., are regularly getting their news exclusively from TikTok. Pro-Palestinian and Hamas, pro-Hamas hashtags are generating 50 times the views on TikTok right now, despite the fact that polling shows Americans overwhelmingly support Israel over Hamas. These videos have more reach than the top 10 U.S. news websites combined. This is not coincidence. The Chinese Communist Party is doing this on purpose. They are pushing this racist agenda with the intention of undermining our democratic values. And if you look at what's happening at Columbia University and other campuses across the country right now, they're winning.
Where do they get these people, Chris? I mean, it's horrible stuff. You know, he's accusing Anthony genocide campaigners of being racists. He let it slip there. What he doesn't like is the fact that people are sharing pro-Palestinian information on TikTok and that they don't have a complete lockdown on the propaganda.
Well, this is the country, of course, that's supposed to champion free speech. It seems free speech is okay so long as you agree with the prevailing establishment worldview. These people are totally out of touch, of course. But the Israel lobby is very powerful in the United States, and many of the senators and people in public office are running scared of the power of the Israel lobby, AIPAC being one such body that wields enormous pressure on anybody who steps out of line and speaks up for justice for the Palestinians. You know, they clamp down on them. And of course, you know, my experience, politicians in this country as well are very much the careerists. I mean, they prioritize their salary, their pension, their all their nice little add-ons that they get, and anything that, you know, could potentially threaten that, they run scared and as it were, you know, buckle under. And that's what we've seen in the UK. That's what we're seeing happening there. But, you know, the vicious assaults that we're seeing on students by the police, you know, the authorities in the United States. Actually, we're seeing this in the continent of Europe as well. This is a direct consequence, I think, Basil, of years and years, decades-long weaponization of anti-Semitism, which reached a fever pitch in the last sort of, 10 years or so. And the fact that we've seen the rise of social media actually able to on independent platforms, you know, like yourselves, able to unpick this propaganda. And that's why, you know, people, I think, are waking up and are not actually accepting the propaganda that they see, the distorted viewpoint, which is peddled by the political class and the legacy media. But the guy, actually, the representative that you just had up there, I mean, claimed that the vast majority of the American public support Israel. I'm not sure that's actually true of recent times. I think that the attitudes are certainly changing, and particularly amongst the younger people in the United States and definitely in the United Kingdom and across Europe. And even in countries like Germany, where they've tried to clamp down on pro-Palestinian expressions of pro-Palestinian demonstrations, rallies and marches, etc., where they've tried to clamp down on that, arresting people and threatening them with all manner of legal ramifications, people are still turning out in their tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, to express their solidarity and their horror at what they are seeing. I mean, some of these images are absolutely ghastly, shocking, shameful, and people are just not prepared to tolerate that. And that's why I think the political class has lost control, and they're frightened about that.
And this whole fake anti-Semitism thing is a diversion. It's designed to take up media oxygen away from the atrocities in Gaza. The mass graves at Nasser and Al-Shifa hospitals this week should really be headline news all week. These are some of the worst war crimes of our lifetimes, Chris. And yet the supposedly hurt feelings of some Jewish students in America are somehow more important. And I would very much doubt that those students are even being honest in the first place. I saw a professor at Columbia University, a Jewish lady, being interviewed saying, well, of course, we're perfectly safe here. Lots of Jewish people amongst the protesters, et cetera, et cetera. It's an entirely synthetic opprobrium and entirely phony outrage that is being amplified. We're going to take a very short break here with the network. When we come back, I'll be asking Chris about the Workers' Party of Great Britain, an insurgent political force and the only anti-murder party standing candidates at the next election. We'll be right back.
I'm CAL FIRE Battalion Chief Isaac Sanchez. And normally we like to provide you with tips on how to keep yourselves and your family safe during wildfires. But given the historic impacts that the weather has had on our state this year, we would like to provide you with tips on how to keep yourself safe during extreme weather. If you reside in an area susceptible to flooding, Please take the necessary steps to prepare to evacuate if advised. Make sure you've identified at least two exit routes out of your neighborhood, as one of them may be blocked or flooded. As the weather develops, remember to check in on vulnerable neighbors and family members. They may need additional time to prepare for evacuation. And just like during a wildfire, if you feel unsafe, please evacuate. You don't have to wait for the order to come. Keep an emergency go bag ready in case you need to evacuate. And always remember to plan for the safety of your pets as well. If you must leave, never drive around roadblocks. It can take as little as 12 inches of water to sweep your vehicle away. And always remember the mantra, turn around, don't drown. Be aware of first responders working in highly impacted areas, especially on the roads. For additional safety tips and updates on CAL FIRE activities, follow us on social media or visit fire.ca.gov.
One in four Australian women experience domestic violence in their lifetime. Staying is dangerous, but leaving can mean homelessness for them and their children. With your generosity, the Salvos can provide crisis services and ongoing support, helping women find a way out of violence and a way back into a safe and stable life. Help us leave no one in need. Please donate to the Red Shield Appeal today.
Patrick Henningsen talks on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
And this is Basil Valentine in for Patrick Henningsen today, Thursday, the 25th of April. I'm delighted to say I'm joined by Chris Williamson, the former Labour MP for Derby. Now, Chris, David Cameron, our unelected Foreign Secretary, says he sees no problem with the fact that he sits in the Lords and not the Commons, and thereby avoids direct questions from the likes of George Galloway, leader of the Workers' Party, who would no doubt be able to dismantle his wholly dishonest and immoral stance on Gaza, as well as Ukraine, for that matter. There have been calls for him to appear at the bar. That's not where you get your subsidised pint of beer or whiskey, but instead the dividing line beyond which people who are not members of Parliament cannot pass. Apparently it was last used by the Duke of Wellington to address MPs in 1814. Cameron claims that this means there's no precedent for him having to face questions from the House of Commons. To me, this indicates the desperate democratic deficit we've got in Britain, Chris. An unelected Foreign Secretary, an unelected Head of State, and an unelected Prime Minister. We've got one chance of breaking through, and that is the general election in the autumn, where the Workers' Party will be standing a record number of candidates. What are the chances of seeing more than George return to Parliament in the autumn?
I think the chances are very good, Basil. I don't want to get ahead of myself, but the fact is that we are in a position now as a Workers' Party, a relatively new party, let's remember. And prior to George's stunning victory in the by-election in Rochdale, we were talking about maybe fielding up to 50 candidates. We didn't think we necessarily would get that many. We said we would collaborate with independents and try and build a broad coalition. However, since George's by-election win, we're now in a position to literally field a candidate in every single constituency in the country. There are 650 constituencies, and we're in a position now to field 650 candidates. Wow. I don't think in the end we will field that many, but we will be certainly, in my opinion, fielding several hundred candidates. Now, that puts us into a different ballpark, because political parties fielding more than 100 candidates are entitled to a party political broadcast. We will be fielding several hundred candidates, which will give us a right to more than one political broadcast, you know, several times. So we'll have that national oxygen of national publicity. But more than that, I mean, I think, as we were saying before the break, you know, the legacy media is not as important as it once was. It's not to underestimate its importance. It is still an important player, but it doesn't have the reach that it previously did. It doesn't have the respect that it previously did. And independent platforms and social media are crucially important, and that's where I think we will also score and have been scoring a lot of hits. I mean, every time George gets up in the House of Commons, for example, his contributions are shared on social media. They get literally millions of views, Basil. I mean, this is astonishing. You know, other parliamentarians also seek the oxygen of of that type of publicity. They get nowhere near. I mean, they're lucky if they get a few thousand. I mean, literally a few thousand. I mean, George is in the hundreds of thousands to millions. And again, I don't want to overstate the, you know, the role of social media. Social media is crucially important, but it's not a panacea. But using all of these things, and the fact is that people now see the Workers' Party as a realistic alternative. People were crying out for an alternative to Labour since Starmer, since the demise of Jeremy Corbyn. And now people are getting to see George, because George has been subjected to the most appalling, vituperative smears for years and years and years, really ever since his stance against the illegal invasion of Iraq over 20 years ago now. And that, you know, that did have some impact on some people. But people who were, you know, a bit unsure about George are increasingly, now they're seeing him in the flesh, in the reality, and his contributions and how sensible and powerful they are in the House of Commons, are having second thoughts and realizing, oh, this guy actually speaks a lot of common sense. So that is driving more people into the arms of the Workers' Party. And so we're getting record numbers of people joining the party. And I think we, as I've said, we'll be fielding several hundred candidates. And I firmly believe, again, I don't want to overstate or be overconfident about our prospects, but I do genuinely believe that we'll be in a position to elect a significant number of candidates at the next election. I think we'll easily get into double figures. That's my prediction. Oh. I'd love to see us get further. I would love to see us in a situation where we could form a government. And just imagine Jeremy Corbyn. Sorry, I beg your pardon. Just imagine George Galloway as the
Prime Minister.
My goodness. Well, Jeremy. And a real comparison to Jeremy, who unfortunately allowed himself to get pushed around by the Israel lobby and the right wings and sought to try to placate them and appease them. But one thing that George said was that the difference between me is that if you slap me, I'll slap you back. And he will slap them back with great force. And that's where I think Jeremy made a mistake, really. He didn't sort of fight back. And they saw that as a form of weakness. And they used that. And eventually they crushed him. But yeah, just imagine a George Galloway government. That'd be wonderful. But I mean, that would be great. And we're certainly fighting for that. I mean, it's not, I mean, nothing's impossible, is it? But I do think we will be certainly in a situation where we will likely to return a good number of MPs. And of course, in those circumstances, Basil, political parties that elect one MP and secure 150,000 votes, or more than one MP, two MPs, they then start to qualify for what's called short money. And this was a form of funding that was pioneered by Ted Short, former Labour minister, whereby political parties can receive some state funding to run the organisation, as it were. Now, you know, the Workers' Party is relatively new. It's still a relatively small acorn, although we're getting lots of new members. We haven't got big donors. We haven't got the trade unions, regrettably, backing us. But this will put us into the Premier League. We'll be in a situation there where we will start to be able to employ full-timers, researchers and so on, and that will enable us to continue to grow again. So if we don't form a government at this election, who knows, we might be in a very, well, we will certainly be in a much stronger position at the subsequent election to do even better than I think we'll be doing when this election comes, which actually could come even before the autumn, you know, Basil. So we're on standby, ready for a summer election, but we'll be ready whenever it comes.
Very quickly, bit of a closed shop, because other than the party political broadcasts, the amount of airtime you get is related to the number of votes you got in the last election, which is a complete nonsense, obviously. And then also the first past the post system doesn't exactly help small parties. So I would imagine you're going to be concentrating your resources in certain target constituencies where things like genocide are particularly unpopular.
Yes, we will be targeting, of course. But we, as I've said, are in a great position where we're going to have hundreds and hundreds of candidates, increasing number of numbers of members, a willingness from the wider general public to support an insurgent party like the Workers' Party. So in addition to those key target seats, we'll be putting a great show on in other constituencies as well. And, you know, we might very well get some surprising results.
To give you one little piece of advice, emphasize the renationalization agenda, because it's enormously popular People are well aware of the fact that they were swindled out of their national assets and now see skyrocketing bills with profits offshore to shareholders. Everybody wants to see water, power and the railways renationalised. And Labour, of course, have dropped the ball.
Yeah.
Chris Williamson, thank you so much for joining us tonight on today's News Talk. Time for our news headlines, and when we come back, we'll be looking at West Africa with the redoubtable Blake Lovewell. Don't...